Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernor.
On this week's show, we're going to talk about Google negotiating with Apple, HBO flirts with a streaming-only service overseas, Amazon prepares to refresh the Kindle, and is the FBI tracking your Apple device IDs? But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And Devendra, you weren't with us last week, so tell us what you've been playing with over the last couple of weeks.
I've been just spending a lot of time in Guild Wars 2. I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I've been waiting for this game a long time. I loved the first one, and Guild Wars in general, like, what I loved about it is the way they basically gave you an MMO and most of the great stuff you get in an MMO without a monthly subscription. So the second game, it's gorgeous. It's still a lot of fun. I like to have like one game around just for me to like level up, because there's a great bit of like what's the chemical? Is it dopamine?
You get
a good rush when you're leveling up properly, for anybody who's played RPGs before. So I kind of like that, and Guild Wars 2 is right now the way I'm doing it. It's a big improvement over the original, I think. This is a game where you can kind of just wander around the world, do things on your own, and not have to deal with a party. But occasionally, like, a big monster will appear or something, and everybody on the map kind of rushes to one location and tries to kill it. There's a lot of group things that you can participate in if you want, but the rest of the time, you're free to, like, just work on your own and, you know, get loot and crap. It's fun. It's gorgeous. It's probably not the revolution I wanted it to be, just because I was really looking for something maybe more along the lines of Phantasy Star Online, which I'm not sure if you guys ever played, but back in the Dreamcast days, that to me is like the epitome of what I want in a connected RPG experience. And I was playing that game on a 56K modem on my Dreamcast. So, you know, if we could do it then, why can't we do it now?
We should at least, at the very least, be able to convert that to a new...
It's a long, long story. That game has been reconverted to modern consoles and stuff, but the community just, it's not the same.
It's not
as
there
it was.
Anymore, yeah.
Yeah, and the team that built the original Phantasy Star Online, they're all kind of split up now across different projects. So they are making like a true sequel to that game that's going to be on the PS Vita, I think, next year. So that's something I'm holding out for. But for
that's
now,
exciting.
Guild Wars 2.
I would get
yeah,
a Vita.
The PS Vita, it's a really nice piece of hardware that I rarely play. So I kind of want a reason to play that too.
Yeah, I gotta say, the Vita, I like the Vita a lot. I have no reason to buy one yet, but having played with I stole one of my friends for a little while. I mean, like, in an age of, if the PS Vita had come out a year ago, 2 years ago, anything close to what it is today, I mean, it would have rocked Nintendo's world in like the hugest way.
Nintendo had to, you know, stop swimming in their pit of money and start developing products. I'm convinced that's what Nintendo spends most of their time doing. They like swim in their giant money pool.
I'm going to be playing with the Wii U next week, actually.
Are you?
Yes.
I'm jealous.
And I am so ready. We'll see how this goes. I am so, like, I'm not really excited for this console.
Yeah,
so I'm glad
know.
I'm getting a chance to get an early look.
I got to say, I would really like, this is going to sound crazy. It's going to sound crazy. But I would like to see what a company like Apple could do if they purchased Nintendo. I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's a crazy idea. But in terms of, like, innovation station, weird UIs, doing funky shit.
Nintendo's going to hold on to their old kind of business model for basically until they die, which will probably be never. I mean, they'll probably have a core, you know, base of users who will keep buying Nintendo for what it is.
It's
I admit I'm part of that. I will probably always buy a Nintendo just for the newest Zelda, just the newest Mario.
Mario's
going to
hold that company up forever.
You know what, Chris, did you buy a 3DS?
No.
Lies. I call lies on you. I bought a 3DS, and I kind of feel sad about it, because now, just a couple months ago, the 3DS XL came out. So I don't know. The Wii U has
done nothing. Is the Excel that much better?
It's just bigger. It's just bigger, but kind of more convenient. And it still doesn't have the second pad. So
how is it bigger but more convenient?
Because it's easier to hold. So people think it's better to play long games on, basically.
Okay.
But the Wii U, for me, is like the one Nintendo thing where I'm like, okay, you know what? No, Nintendo. I will not take your tablet controller. I will not take your, last-gen technology trying to rebadge it as something new. Never again, Nintendo. So
fool me once.
Yeah.
And you have to really wonder why, because they had the money to develop something.
They don't think like that. Nintendo doesn't think like that. They don't think next generation. It's not
like the Ford of video games, right? Like the GM of video games during the declining.
They hit on the magic of casual gaming before iOS games and before all this mobile stuff. And now they're actually facing competition from true casual games. So,
that's what I say, the GM thing. They're like GM in the 90s when they figured out how to make the best SUV. And they just kept on making them bigger and bigger and bigger, but not innovating any of the actual gas mileage or quality of the car or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was the same car for like 12 years. And then suddenly they're like, wait, how come we're going to go bankrupt? I feel like that's the trajectory.
You know what they need is they need someone, and this may be a bad analogy, I'll admit in advance, but they need someone like a Howard Stringer who can come in and bring a completely different sort of mental sensibility to the company in general.
That's never going to happen.
Although that didn't work out very well for Howard Stringer.
Well, the problem with
go ahead.
I mean, the problem with Nintendo, Dwayne, as you're comparing them to Apple, I mean, the biggest comparison is, like Apple, they sell their hardware at a pretty substantial profit, and so they're sitting on like redonkulous cash reserves. Like they could
Donkey
just sit
Kong
there
levels of cash reserves.
Yeah, they could just sit there for like 3 years and do nothing and like not release any product. I'm convinced they spend like most of their time swimming in a pool of money.
I imagine Satoru Iwata like sitting there at the top of the Donkey Kong level and like fresh young engineers with cool innovative ideas. He's just throwing barrels at them. It's like no, until somebody jumps over and something happens.
Yeah, no, that's the position they're in. It's unfortunate because it is one of the most innovative, but one of the laziest. They're like the I don't know. Like, there's not really an analogy.
This conversation went on a weird tangent, but you know what? They actually did innovate with the Wii, and then it kind of just all went downhill from there. My biggest problem with Nintendo is that they have forsaken their core gaming crowd and their truest fans. And, the NES was the reason I got into tech, was the reason I love video games, and it pretty much shaped my childhood. So it is kind of heartbreaking to see Nintendo go along this route. So I'm hoping the Wii U can change that somehow.
Bad, so they learn the need to actually make products.
maybe helping to spur on some new games that are actually innovative.
We're a tech company. Making a product seems like an important part of that.
Yeah.
Dwayne, is there something that you've been playing with this last week or last couple weeks? We missed you last week as well.
I was in Iceland and I was visiting. It was a bachelor party. It was pretty exciting. But
in
on
Iceland?
The way there, in Iceland.
Good job.
So I went out there and I was like, I want to read some stuff on the plane. And I found this app called Next Issue for first month is free, but after that it's $15. You basically get access to like 30 separate magazines, which would cost you like far more than that on your iPad. And I like got into like architectural. I rediscovered all these magazines I used to look at when I was younger, like Architectural Digest. And I'm not going to lie, I like Vogue. Wired is on it. You know, there are a whole bunch of magazines. You get the New Yorker. And you get the historical. The only thing is you don't get the paper copies. You just get the iPad copy, which is fine for me because I don't need any more paper in my life. So I definitely made use of that. It's taken up 2.7 gigs on my device with all the content that I've downloaded from it. But it's really something. It's really great.
Cool. Chris, how about yourself?
I have not been really playing with new technologies recently, not going to lie.
That's cool. We can move.
Working with some cool stuff, which I can't talk about, but it mostly involves Vim and command lines and Python, which is not really new.
Well, maybe you can talk about it when it is okay to talk about it.
When it isn't, I will definitely be talking about it. It will definitely be worth talking about. But for right now, it's mostly Vim and phone calls.
All right. Well, let's jump right into headlines then. We've been talking about the Apple stuff, the new devices, for some time. We've been building up to this event. Well, Apple on Tuesday sent out invites for an actual upcoming event happening in San Francisco on September 12th. The invitation says the event will take place at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which they've had events at, many events at before, at 10 a.m. And this is the event where they, it's widely expected that they're going to announce the next generation iPhone at the event. And if you've seen this, the artwork on this event,
I can't,
you think
it's going
to be called Five? I can't tell if that might be part of this.
This is
Mason, the giant five on the picture.
So disappointed.
Okay.
We don't know what it is. It's just, I feel like this is a great way to tease the tech press. We've pretty much been talking about this this date for months now. Yeah. And I think it was,
years.
Who was it? It was, I forget which site it was. But it's actually a new and up and coming site that's been getting a lot of, iMore, I believe. They've been getting a lot of scoops lately. And I think, you know, they're just showing up as like an impressive scoop getter for Apple stuff now. So props to them. They call this date way back when.
Have you ever seen, were you just being facetious, Devinder, or have you actually seen, I've never seen Apple tease something like this that they didn't back up with a concrete sort of thing during the announcement.
It depends, but at the same time, like, you know, this is not the same Apple as it was a year ago. And also, like, again, I think the iPad's renaming kind of signified a big shift in terms of how they were considering their mobile products. So, you know, it seems just as plausible for me that this new iPhone could just be called iPhone. Personally, I kind of like iPhone 5 at this point, so I hope they stick with that.
I gotta say, like, for me, okay, iPhone 5 is great SEO, right? You type an iPhone 5, if you want to write an article about the next iPhone, you type an iPhone 5.
That's the way you refer to it right now.
Right,
so that iPhone does not get you any juice.
It doesn't get you any juice. So my thing though is that, you know, on some level, I've heard some really ridiculous like theories about what that five means. Right, one of them was like, well, you know, it's about the fact that you're gonna have five icons instead of four,
no.
Shit like that.
Oh,
it's
my
awesome.
Gosh, no,
right? It
no.
was really far fetched. The only possible thing that the five could mean, aside from calling the phone the iPhone 5, is to just announce that it's been 5 years since the iPhone came out.
No.
You know, and it's not going to happen. It's going to be called the iPhone 5. It's part of it. The 5 year thing
is
only
a significant milestone, guys. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to think of what the mobile world was like 5 years ago.
And then look at the fact that with the iPad, if there is an iPad Mini coming out and they're looking forward to that, you can't really have an iPad 3 and an iPad Mini because you don't really know like where does the Mini fit in. But if you just call it an iPad, and then like how you had an iPod, then you have an iPod Mini. Then suddenly it becomes less apparent. The number becomes.
That does not make any sense to me, but okay. I can understand that reasoning, but that sounds like Apple fans like overthinking this.
Apple fans overthinking something?
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really overthinking, because if you think about it, if you have an iPad 3, you have an iPad Mini, and it's called, like, I have the iPad Mini 2 in a year, and the iPad 4, it does become confusing. If you just say there's an iPad and an iPad Mini, because you have multiple products in the line, in that new line they're building, then that, to me, makes it a bit more clear. Whereas with the iPhone, we haven't seen anything suggesting that there's going to really be like a second type of iPhone. A cheaper iPhone, a smaller iPhone. You know, the product has been working well as a passed-down product, with the previous generation being the lower end the next year. So I feel like they're in a fine place to continue using the numbering scheme.
Well, the one thing that we haven't actually talked about very much, but if you look at so many Android phones now, there was that great Verizon 4G ad making fun of like the crazy ass Android phone names and Android tablet names. Today, Motorola just showed off the Droid.
Droid Razer HD,
and also the Droid Razer HD Max, which has more battery life. So I think one good thing about the iPad, just kind of slicing that name to just iPad, will avoid any of that cruft of like future revisions, and that's a good thing. So that's one reason why just be iPhone.
We shared a thing here on the show where I remember I shared with you guys. It was a chart, and it said, is it an Android or is it a condom? Because they had Desire, they had, like, you know, all this crap.
Yeah.
And, like, literally, I think it was like 60% of the names were actually condoms and Android phones.
Yeah.
So it was like, wow, there you go.
The Android Trojan. The Android
Magnum. All right,
let's just say this. Yeah.
Let's move on here. Google CEO Larry Page and Apple CEO Tim Cook have been conducting behind-the-scenes talks, according to Reuters, about a range of intellectual property matters, including the mobile patent dispute between the companies. People familiar with the matter said, which is that key word, that key phrase that they always use when they can't tell you exactly who said it. The two companies are keeping lines of communications open at a high level against the backdrop of Apple's legal victory in a patent infringement case against Samsung, which uses the Android software. One possible scenario under consideration could be a truce involving disputes over basic features and functions in Google's Android software, one source said, but it's unclear whether Page and Cook are discussing a broad settlement of the various disputes between the two companies or are focused on a more limited set of issues. So do you think that the whole Samsung, Apple's victory over Samsung made Google a little nervous? Or maybe it was Tim Cook's opportunity to say, hey, you know, we could be coming after you next, so why don't we try and soften the blow a little bit here and
it's undoubted,
negotiate.
Guys, when Apple was creating the legal strategy for their Android takedown, the first thing they did was hit the smallest company, which was HTC. They got a victory in that, and what's the thing that matters the most in when you're working in court? Not you know, if there's law
precedent
that hasn't been passed legislatively, it's case law.
Yeah.
So they're able to leverage the HTC settlement and everything around that, and basically use that as a testing ground to see how well they would do if they went up against the big boy. And they did that. And they went up against Samsung. And, you know, they had that deal with Nokia where they're actually paying out Nokia. And the fact is, Nokia is making more money probably on that payout than they are making on their own phones. Right? So these deals are the bread and butter of commerce. And this whole Samsung thing, I think both Google was like, yeah, I can talk. And Apple's like, we don't want to go through this again. With Samsung, you know, it's easy to make an enemy out of Samsung in the public eye, especially. They're Korean. They make reasonable products, but they're
Korean.
No, I mean, they're overseas.
Wait. Does the public eye hate kimchi or something?
Reasonable products. That also is a deal breaker.
They're an overseas company. They're overseas based. Yet their products are clearly kind of on the knockoff side, more so than everybody else's. Like HTC and all the other guys, they definitely make products that have elements, but they're not as clearly knocked off as that. And the fact is, like, if we go after them, it's going to be a bit of a battle, and we have other battles to fight in terms of, like, you know, we're using some of their products. We're using, you know, there's a lot there. But the public image, it's going to be more on Apple's side. Now, going after Google, people spend a lot of time on Google. There are more people using Google than there are using Apple products. And I'll say that straight up, because everyone gets on the web and they go to Google, right?
But the public... The public perception doesn't matter at all in these cases. I mean, you know, it comes down to jurors and what they can prove for it.
I agree with your overall thing, but I mean, like, you're missing the history of this. I mean, like, the whole set of these lawsuits came because Jobs was pissed off at Google and wanted to go thermonuclear on there. I mean, I think this is clearly an example of, you know, Apple CEO realized that he has won a moral victory, which means that from the perspective of the troops and the sort of legacy of Steve Jobs, he actually has an opportunity to do what I think as a businessman he thinks is a smarter move, which is basically sort of go for a more truce deal type situation rather than a sort of scorched earth situation, which basically just leaves everybody worse off. I mean, I don't know. He seems like a true on businessman to me, and like
the better one to kiss up, make nice, and say, okay, let's have a solution where we can all win. Because going after you is going to cause me a lot more problems than it did when I went.
Yeah, this feels like much more Tim Cook than Steve Jobs. This feels like Tim Cook being Tim Cook. And in this particular case, I think this is exactly the thing to do. Cause
probably in a good way, right?
You Apple also had trauma. The trauma of being... Apple also had the trauma of being... taken out by Microsoft early in their game. They came out with this OS. People liked it. It was expensive. Everything was expensive back then. And then what happens? These Microsoft guys come out with Windows 95, and they just get their ass beat. And that can't happen again.
There's a lot more context to that, Dwayne. You know it. It's more like the way I see this, right? Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense for Google to start these negotiations now, because the one thing they can't have is people afraid to build Android phones. Google has enjoyed like years and years of success of people just like, oh, Android's free. Okay, I'll build a cheap ass phone and I'll sell it for pennies on the dollar or something. That's kind of how Android has grown, and for Android to continue to grow, people can't be afraid to adopt it. So they kind of have to squash any of these legal issues at the Android level, because a lot of the things that Apple was suing HTC for, even some of the things it was suing Samsung for, were core to Android. So clearly, like, you know, they target HTC first, but also they target Samsung, because you could make the biggest lesson out of them. Because I think fundamentally a lot of Android manufacturers were guilty of copying to a certain extent what Apple was doing. Look at LG. Like LG, you know, Samsung is a big Korean company. LG, also a big Korean company, but kind of B or C level compared to like King Samsung, right? They make display panels, but and they make like lesser products all around. They do everything Samsung does, but not as good, you know? So you look at LG's phones and they look like not as good Samsung phones, which themselves were kind of trying to be iPhones. So I think everybody was guilty of this. And now Google just needs to figure out a way to fix it.
Yeah, so clearly the idea is, again, the precedent. You set the precedent with HTC, it's a small one. You go up to Samsung because it's a huge one. And then everyone's got to take a notice and say, like, what can we do to, like, not have the wrath fall on top of us?
Right.
But there is a lot of work in going after Google. Google's team is going to be incredibly hard-hitting. They bought Motorola, so they've got that book behind them. It's just not going to be as easy a fight. And if they can get around this with just a couple cups of coffee and a couple lawyers and figuring out what they want to keep and kind of like Intel and AMD. There was that big lawsuit, there was $1 billion or $1.25 billion passed back and forth, and then part of the settlement was that hey, let's just start talking about what we have and let's share some technology, because if we don't share it, we're both going to end up in deep shit. And I feel like that's what's going on here, because who knows, Apple may be with Nokia ready to be purchased by anybody with $5 and a huge patent book there, unless there's room for some of these tiles on the chessboard to change. And I feel like it's a smart move, like Chris said, to just do the business side, focus on the business, forget the morality and move it forward, because everyone's going to win that way.
Variety reports that HBO will make the Nordic region the first market where its programming will be available to consumers without requiring that they have a pay TV subscription, with the launch of HBO Nordic AB in mid-October. HBO spokesman made clear that this launch does not reflect a strategic change for the company and any of its current markets. Each market is unique, and HBO approaches each one with what we consider to be the best business model specific to that territory, he said. But the announcement does mark a major shift for HBO's traditional business model. Scandinavia is a market where HBO doesn't have to protect an entrenched business model as lucrative as the one in U.S., where a standalone product would jeopardize its deals with distributors from Comcast to DirecTV. Regardless, do you guys think that this is HBO testing the waters to potentially bring that sort of business model to the U.S.? Or
Absolutely. They're, even if they're not using this as a big shift, the fact is, by seeing how well it performs, they begin to understand, what the potential is elsewhere. They get data, and getting that data is going to be essential to them making a shift later if they decide to do it. That's huge. As a person who spent a lot of time in Scandinavia, it's a great market. In the wintertime, people will be in their houses, all cozy, surrounded by wood and blankets, watching Game of Thrones and things like it. And frankly, especially Game of Thrones, like if you're in Winterfell, that's like the north of Norway anyway.
What do you think, Devendra?
The thing is, HP makes a lot of money with its current set up in the U.S. And that's because, unlike a lot of other countries, cable systems, dish systems, the cable systems in particular are set up like a monopoly in the U.S., how they've carved out certain areas and other systems can't intrude on it. There isn't much choice in America, mm-hmm. so... For that reason, I think HBO just feels like they're better off forcing people to pay $20 a month to get access to their channels via their service. But this particular test seems like it could be useful for other countries where maybe the cable systems aren't as, monopolistic and maybe aren't as widespread as they are in America. This is a good way to get other countries to see HBO content and also keep it out of the hands
and not
of, like,
pirating.
Americans. Exactly. Like, they can actually make money off of this rather than going to, Pirate Bay or something.
I don't think this is really as much about piracy for HBO as much as it is about just testing. I mean, I think they realize that the direction that cable is going and that it's not certain, but it's certainly a distinct possibility that cable is going to go away from a sort of totally wrapped-in model. I mean, I don't think they're betting on it, but... they want to have a test as to what it runs, how they might be able to monetize otherwise. And if they can do that in a way that also expands their market into places where they might not be able to get that wrapped in cable market, then this seems like a good test of that.
There's also the fact that these are very wealthy countries, right? Like Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. I don't know if they're going to be in Iceland or wherever, but in Norway, Denmark, Sweden, these are countries with the disposable income. The people have the disposable income, which really reflects what people with HBO here have. Like, if they were going to, like, Calcutta and being like, yeah, we're going to do HBO Go in Calcutta, like, people don't necessarily have money for that. They would do the pirating. But here, it's a convenience, and that really works. There's also the fact that they don't necessarily have to write 3 different languages. Right, like if they write it in Swedish, the other two will get it in terms of subtitles and other shit like that. So there's a certain diminished overhead. So there's something to that, too.
Mm-hmm. The Verge has an exclusive peek at what appears to be a refreshed backlit Kindle Touch, presumably to be launched on the 6th, which is tomorrow by this recording. So by the time people hear this on the 8th, it will already have been launched. Along with a refreshed Kindle Fire, The Verge also had what they claim is an exclusive peek at the new Kindle Fire 2, but that had been disputed by some readers. The retail
and
name...
there's also news tonight about a potential, like, they've heard a Kindle phone will be shown tomorrow or some sort of
Amazon
phone.
This is the first I've heard of that. Really? A Kindle phone?
Yeah, that hit like a couple hours ago.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there was also a commercial on the NFL tonight.
Not for a Kindle phone.
It was a Kindle. It looked like a Kindle Touch, but it was like brilliantly white on the other side.
Yeah,
it was
the Kindle Touch that the Verge has peeked at is backlit, and they're calling it paper white, or it could be what they call paper white. It's a reference to the unit's improved display over the so-called Pearl e-ink that Amazon has been using since the third generation Kindle. And the backlit display is almost certainly designed to be the answer to Barnes & Noble's Nook Simple Touch with Glow Light, introduced earlier this year. Which, I mean, I think this is... because I saw the Nook, and I'm like, this backlight is perfect if only the Kindle had this. And now it seems like it's going to...
Although it sounds like this is a little different, because the Kindle, the Nook one... is overhead, so it's like coming down from the top of the bezel. It sounds like this one is a legitimate like backlight, so it could be a different difference in implementation. You know what I wish, guys? I wish we got these lights on the non-touch e-readers, because after living with my Kindle Touch for the past few months, I kind of hate it. I should have returned it when I had the chance. Touch does not belong in e-readers.
It's unnecessary.
It's the biggest pain. Like, imagine if you were reading a paperback book and your finger just like grazed the page, and oh my god, you're 10 chapters in, and now you can't figure out where you were before because there's no easy like recall button. It's kind of ridiculous. So for the love of God, let's. I wish we would give up on touch e-readers, but it sounds like we're just gonna keep going. Yeah,
we're stuck with it.
We're stuck with it, and the more convenient Kindles won't get lights.
The Kindle. I think Amazon is I don't think they're going to like phase out the actual the normal Kindle anytime soon, but I do think that they were trying to move the UI experience to something that was slightly more sexy than the button version. Because the thing is, the keyboard on the button version was
Yeah, but have you tried typing? Do you have a touch Kindle, Dwayne?
No, I tried one out in the store and I was
okay.
Not
so sure. typing on the button Kindle, kind of a painful, right?
Yeah, they're both.
But the thing is, touch, you're not getting any tactile feedback, and you're dealing with the e-ink refresh rate issue. So touch is like, for me, is at least 2 to 3 times slower touch typing on the Kindle Touch versus the older one. You know, the older one, like an old computer, you could just hit a bunch of keys and assume it's registering these things, and eventually you'll see it all on the screen. Not so with this one.
Oh,
anyway.
Yeah, latest is not, you know me, latest is not necessarily greatest. So I'm a big fan of the button Kindle that I've had for a couple years now. 2010.
Kindle Fire. What do you guys think about the refresh one? Because the other news on the Kindle Fire was that there's going to be, you know, a new, faster, fully revamped, remodeled one at 200, and potentially they're going to keep the old one around, maybe slightly remodel it, but it may be ad-supported. And I think that could be ingenious, especially if they can hit $100. A $100 ad-supported Kindle Fire would be huge.
$100. Are they actually making enough on the ads with this to actually make it worth it? I mean, that's one question I have. I mean, I know that it's a loss leader thing for them to sell ads on it, but like, do they have any sort of sense of like, is this a sustainable business model?
Amazon doesn't tell us how much revenue they've taken per device, per whatever. But the I feel like the CPM is really high.
It must be, because the way that that works, they're unlike any other device, right? On the Kindle e-readers, the ads show up like in screensaver mode or on the library at the bottom of the page. That's like prime real estate. And also, it only the ads only take off like $25 to $40 of a price, at least with the current devices. So I wouldn't be surprised if Kindle Fire got really close to $100 with
that. And the ads are not – I mean, remember, the Kindles are pretty you can get your stuff on the Kindle without buying things. You can get, but people overwhelmingly use the Amazon store, and that's really where they make their money. There's a reason why a paperback book costs $8 and a Kindle book costs $6, you know, or sometimes $9. You know what I mean? Like there's still a lot of money that they're generating, a lot of revenue they're generating from the books themselves, and that's going to cover the cost of these devices. You know, with Apple, it's really about the hardware with the software as a purchasing point, the iTunes store. You know, everything I've read says it breaks even or makes a little bit of money. It's not like a crazy big deal. But when it comes to the Kindle, they're making serious money on the content because it's a content-focused device in a way that the other ones aren't. Like, the iPad will sell, and people will be like, oh, you've got iMovie, you've got paper, you've got all these things that can help you create stuff. The Kindle is clearly a consumption device.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Jeff Bezos' grand plan to eventually make these free? Isn't that the idea? That with each iteration, it's going to be cheaper and cheaper?
I mean, that's clearly where they've been moving towards. I forget if that's like part of his grand plan. But really, why shouldn't they be free? Because really, it's all about the ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
That's
something
Amazon has gotten right since the beginning with the Kindle. There have been e-readers before the Kindle, but Amazon's ecosystem kind of gave it the kickstart that whole genre needed. And the same thing with the Kindle Fire. It wasn't a great tablet, but it was by far the most useful Android tablet because it wasn't like relying on the kind of mess of the Android market and Google's mishmash of media and apps and whatnot. The Kindle Fire knew what it wanted to be. It's a legit consumption device tied to Amazon's services and basically functions as a nice visual catalog for Amazon.com. So that kind of works out all around.
The added version of the added value of Amazon Prime Video just going right to it.
It gives you another reason to subscribe to Amazon Prime. Like all these things hooking together to create a monster service that is Amazon.
Right.
And services are really where they're at. Like I really feel like the one thing the Kindle Fire 2 has got to do is, you know, it doesn't have to overwhelm it, but it definitely has to put a kick in the pants of Google's Nexus 7 device.
Yeah, the Nexus 7 is fantastic.
It's phenomenal.
Let me reiterate that. Yeah, it's one of the best. It's one of the best tablets out there at $200. It's a freaking steal. It's kind of ridiculous.
It's a brilliant. I'm gonna go beyond and say that it's not even just when I look at it. I don't even see it as just a tablet. I think it serves the Kindle-y role, it serves the normal Kindle, the e-paper one. It's not e-paper, but it serves that role in terms of just like small, throw it anywhere, whatever. It serves the 10-inch tablet role in some ways because you can play a game on it, you can watch a movie on it, it's whatever. And it's kind of like, to me, that's like, that's more of a PDA than my iPhone is, just because it's one of those things that you can keep around your office and get a lot of stuff done on. It's when you look at the Star Trek pads and everything, they're all around that size. They all have like that ability to hold it with one hand without it getting tired and tap away on it. Like we have a couple in the office. It's like a really, to me, that's like a groundbreaking device. And the fact that we're even talking about the possibility of a smaller iPad goes to show that, you know, despite Steve Jobs' hatred of the very idea of it, speculation surrounding a small iPad. I mean, people have gone so far as to say this resolution, this many inches precisely, all this crap shows that this it's really made waves. It's really made waves.
I'm excited. Definitely. And I think Apple's assumption that the iPad was like a nice, easy device to kind of recline with and just consume the web. Once normal people started getting their hands on it, like when I'm reading on my iPad, I feel stress in my wrists, and it's not just because I'm typing all day every day. When I'm relaxing, I want something that's light. I want something no heavier than a Kindle, basically. And the Nexus 7 comes really close. The 7-inch tablets are the best tablet for kind of just reclining and not, you know, feeling like you're having to hold up a computer.
Yeah, the iPad is a cinematic experience, I think, for most. You want to watch a movie on it? Like boom, you know. And the thing is, with
an 1024 display,
My iPad's the So what I'm saying is, you put that. The thing is, once you have it, you put it down on the tray table in the airplane. You put it down on the table, you know, or wherever you are, or you use the you use the little cover that folds over and folds back and all this other stuff. And you're not really using it completely actively, right? Whereas with the Kindle, you're really using it as you. I mean, at the Kindle, the Nexus 7. You're really running around with it. You're running around with it. With the iPad, you're like, ooh, should I run around with it? I don't know. And at the price point, you're like, fuck. If something happens to it, that's gonna suck. But I mean, my iPad is $900.
Yeah. There's definitely a point there with the $200 device. I feel like if I lost it or misplaced or something,
yeah,
it would suck. But you'd be like, okay,
yeah,
my iPad is $900.
Yeah.
It's fucking nuts.
All right, and on that note, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor, Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book, I actually had a different book picked until I saw that this book had just come into Audible within the last week. And it is called No Easy Day, the First-Hand Account of the Mission That Killed Osama Bin Laden. And so I'm normally not one for, like, political books, but this one just is like a popcorn munching, you know, this one grabs you. For the first time anywhere, the first-person account of the planning and execution of the Bin Laden raid from a Navy SEAL who confronted the terrorist mastermind and witnessed his final moments. From the streets of Iraq to the rescue of Captain Richard Phillips in the Indian Ocean, and from the mountaintops of Afghanistan to the third floor of Osama bin Laden's compound, Operator Mark Owen of U.S. Naval Special Warfare Development Group, commonly known as SEAL Team 6, has been part of some of the most memorable special operations in history, as well as countless missions that never made headlines. No Easy Day puts listeners alongside Owen and other hand-picked members of the 24-man team as they trained for the biggest mission of their lives. The blow-by-blow narrative of the assault, beginning with the helicopter crash that could have ended Owen's life, straight through the radio call confirming bin Laden's death, is an essential piece of modern history. So this sounds very exciting to me, and I think it's definitely one that I'll have to pick up.
Sounds better than that Navy SEAL movie, Act of Valor.
Yeah. Or this sounds like the precursor to that other movie coming out whose title I can never remember. It's got zero in it, but it has nothing to do with the with SEAL Team 6. It's got some arcane title, something something zero, zero something something. So
doesn't even sound worth remembering.
Yeah. But apparently that one's going to be kind of the same sort of cover the same kind of ground. Anyway, this audio book or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles could be yours today by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. If you don't like the 30-day trial, you still get to keep the audiobook at the end of your trial. And you go to that site, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. It helps our show out. So there's your chance to pick that up. And please use that URL when you're going to pick your Audible book. All right, we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a couple of new mobile devices that came out today, and an alleged breach from the FBI of Apple ID numbers, for iPhone ID numbers. So let's take a listen to a little bit of music here and come on back.
Hey, hey, the clouds are away. The stroll for the donkeys and the innocents can all sleep safely. All sleep safely. My, my son is pie. His father for the cannons and the guilty ones can all sleep safely. All sleep safely. And all the world is football shaped. It's just for me to kick in space. And I can see his smell, touch, taste. And I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 senses moving overtime. Trying to take this all in. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 senses moving overtime. Trying to taste the thing between a lemon and a lime. Pain and pleasure and the church bell softly chime.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the Roundtable podcast, where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Duane DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor, and let's talk about this anti-sec hacking issue. The anti-sec, which is they're kind of a spin-off group from Anonymous, the hacktivists. Anyway, anti-sec claims to have released a set of more than 1 million Apple unique device identifiers, UDIDs, obtained from breaching the FBI, allegedly breaching the FBI. The group claims to have over 12 million IDs, as well as personal information such as usernames, device names, notification tokens, cell phone numbers, and addresses. They published the UDID numbers to call attention to the suspicions that the FBI used the information to track citizens. The FBI has shot down that claim, stating that the computer from which the data was supposedly taken was never hacked. What's more, it said it never gathered information in the first place. Apple has weighed in as well, saying the FBI has not requested this information from Apple, nor have we provided it to the FBI or any organization. Additionally, with iOS 6, we've introduced a new set of APIs meant to replace the use of the UDID and will soon be banning use of UDID. An Apple spokeswoman told All Things D. So the question is, where did the document come from, really? The ball is now in anti-sec court if, as anti-sec says, the document in question came from an FBI-owned computer and was taken using a breach that took advantage of a vulnerability in Java. Then anti-sec is readily admitting that the person who carried out the act has committed a federal crime. And I think the best kind of thing to come out of this whole incident was we got to see Gawker reporter Adrian Chen dressed in a ballet tutu with a shoe on his head.
Wait, I missed that part of it. That totally yeah. makes this whole story worth it.
Yeah. No, anti-sec demanded, they said, no more interviews to anyone until Adrian Chen gets on the front page of Gawker for a whole day with a huge picture of him wearing dressed in a ballet tutu with a shoe on his head. And he complied.
He's such a trooper.
Wow.
That's
awesome.
Journalism held. That's great.
Journalism held hostage, man.
And journalism complies.
I have a feeling he would have done that anyway, regardless.
Yeah, he's kind of a funny guy, so yeah.
So is this something
Apple... Wait, let's back up to the FBI's defense on this. So their defense is that laptop was never compromised. Also, we didn't have the information.
Right, right. They say
so. The laptop that didn't have the information, which would be all of the FBI's laptops, wasn't compromised because it didn't have any of the information, which wasn't there.
Yeah, that's where it's murky. It's basically saying we may have the information, but that's not germane here. The laptop that was taken or hacked into, or whatever.
They did say that they never gathered the information in the first place. And Apple has said that they've never given the FBI that information, nor has the FBI ever requested it. So,
except, I mean, people have verified that, like, these are real UDIDs. This is not.
Absolutely.
These are the actual UDIDs of people out there. So somebody's laptop who had this ridiculous database.
Cache of, UDIDs.
I mean, to some extent, it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it could be the NSA, it could be the CIA, it could be the FBI, it could be, you know, the lawyer for Apple in their case. You know, the danger in collecting this information is that by collecting it, you make a single point of failure. I mean, the problem with the UDID is that, unfortunately, it's used by an awful lot of groups as the identification for the phone and therefore has access to a huge amount of information depending on what the person who did the phone is done with. And unfortunately, there's not a great deal that owners of phones can do if I'm reading the stories right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, Apple is clearly moving away from using this as a means to identify the phones. So just something to be said about that.
Well, that's good, but I mean, it's still – who knows when iOS 6 is going to come out? We still have – a month or so at least until people actually start getting it.
Do we have anything to worry about these UDIDs floating out there? I mean, from what I understand, they can't really, unless they're paired with the actual user name and addresses, they're kind of harmless out there on their just out there on their own.
But LulzSec has proved that they're able to do this. Who was it that said that? Hold on, somebody recently said that they were able to pair UDIDs to usernames and shit. It was pretty radical.
I thought it was connected with like OpenFaint.
Yeah, there have been some gaming apps that have been not too secure with user IDs paired with usernames and other identifying information. But I think that for the most part, a lot of those game apps have over the last couple of years changed the way that they process the information so that they don't reveal that kind of information. And I think OpenFaint definitely has changed their the way they process that information. But I think the issue is that there are so many other gaming apps out there, that can't be accounted for the way they process that information.
Yeah.
And where did this come from? Where did these user IDs leak from in the first place? Is the question. If the FBI isn't responsible,
yeah,
you know, Atisek got them from somewhere.
Yeah, and it's a real list. I don't know. I mean, I think of this, I mean, from my perspective as a developer, like, it's more along the lines to me of, like, don't think in terms of when you're developing an application and when you're developing a if you're building a mobile game and you want access to somebody's social data or whatnot, like, don't think in terms of, like, movie plot threats. Don't think in terms of like, oh, well, I can't imagine a situation in which somebody could use this information nefariously. If it's information that identifies people and if it's information that connects between multiple types of accounts, be as decoupled as possible and be as judicious as possible with whatever information you collect. Collect the minimum amount of information necessary to do what you need to do, because anything more and you are making yourself a target for somebody else to make something out of it. Like, the more I've studied about security, the more I've realized you're never going to guess what hackers are going to do ahead of time. You're never going to guess every possible situation that can come out of it. Your best bet is to decouple your data as much as possible and not collect information just for the sake of collecting it. And as always, always try to connect stuff through, you know, one-time keys or hashes or salted
hashes,
password. But anything that basically allows you to be like, okay, well, that data's bad. I'm going to, you know, do a new one. I mean, if you're a developer, you've used SSH, and you know how SSH keys work. And you have your public key and you have your private key. And you only ever give out the public key. Because you could just give out as many of those as you want and just kill them as soon as they're compromised. Mm-hmm. And you need to do the same thing when you're dealing with OAuth tokens or whatever it is you're doing. Take that approach of having something – if something is uniquely identifying, don't ever give it out. If it's a password or an email address or a credit card or even the last four digits of a credit card,
right,
don't give out something that's going to be uniquely identifying because it's going to be compromised.
We've seen that. What we do here between SHA-256 and like MD5 or whatever, there are a couple of like pretty reasonable ways to make sure that even if you get broken into, it's going to be relatively useless to whoever gets in there. But I think Chris's approach is right. There's no reason to collect information you don't super require. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, we're in an age of data mining, yeah, whatever, but if you want to be a responsible developer, part of it is just respecting the fact that you take what you need and nothing else, and it actually makes you, it's less overhead for you. And the fact is, when hackers are trolling for whatever, they're going to be looking to someone else, to not to you, right? Like, it's like, it's not worth, it's the juice isn't worth the squeeze for me to try to get into their system or whatever. And I think that's what's key.
Mm-hmm.
All right, here. Let's move on here. Nokia has officially unveiled its new flagship smartphone, the Lumia 920. It's received a bump in specs over the previous iteration with a 1.5 gig Qualcomm Snapdragon S4 dual core processor, a slightly larger 4.5 inch curved glass display with a 768 by 1280 resolution. That's the resolution of the display. 2,000
mega amps, I believe.
It's mega amps, man. It's the battery.
Yeah, it's the battery.
Right.
It's a big phone.
It's a pretty big battery.
And a new display that Nokia is calling Pure Motion HD Plus, which they claim is the best smartphone display innovation the company has ever made, with better than HD resolution and fast refresh rates. Now, Devinder, you've seen this phone personally, haven't you?
I have. Saw them up close today. So the Lumia 920 is the new flagship, but they also showed off the 820, which is this. It's a 4.3-inch, slightly slimmer model, and not as expensive looking. It'll be their mid-range thing. But guys, we've talked a lot about the Lumia phones in general and about Microsoft's partnership with Nokia. I feel like now we're finally seeing some great results from this partnership. The Lumia 920 is a freaking gorgeous phone. I only had a very small amount of time to actually touch one.
Uh-huh.
It was a prototype unit, and they wouldn't let us go past the start screen, even though I'm seeing all sorts of sites with in-depth hands-ons, which makes that's a lot of fun to see, by the way. It feels good. It feels fantastic, actually. It feels more solid than an iPhone 4S at this point, because the back is still that great, ultra-strong polycarbonate. It's a unibody design, so it feels sturdy. And Nokia says that the glass is even stronger than previous models. Previous models, by the way, one Nokia guy used the screen to, hammer in some nails just to show how strong the screen is, and the screen was fine. I think you can find that video online somewhere.
This would be Gorilla Glass 3, wouldn't it?
It may be Gorilla Glass. It may not be. They do all sorts of things to make this glass strong. That's what you're saying.
Well, it's curved. It could be Gorilla Glass, but the thing is it's curved, and we haven't seen any other Gorilla Glass entries, I believe, are curved like this. So, I don't know. But this phone, it feels great. It looks tremendous. I think what's most interesting, Windows Phone 8 is going to be a nice advancement for Windows Phone in general. Has a more revamped start screen. Has all sorts of new features. One of the cool things they showed off today were these new camera apps. So third-party companies can create little apps that can just utilize your camera in cool ways. On iPhone now and Android, you'd probably just download a completely separate app for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like the way they're organizing it in Windows Phone 8. Microsoft has an app for Photosynth, which is their panoramic service, And there's like a CNN iReport app too, so you can instantly send stuff to there. But I think what's really exciting me about the Lumia 920 is their camera tech. So they brought in some of the really cool elements of PureView from the PureView 808. That was the crazy 41 megapixel camera phone, that they showed off at Mobile World Congress. That thing ran what was it? It was a Symbian Bell, I believe. So nobody in their right mind should buy that phone. But what we're seeing in this Lumia is some great, great camera technology. In particular, the floating lens technology that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Basically, it allows crazy amounts of image stabilization. Image stabilization happening right on the lens. They showed like a deconstructed version of this in a slide, and there are just a ton of springs in the whole camera assembly. What this means is that you can shoot video and be walking around, and it won't be shaky and ugly like it would on every other camera phone. It also allows the Lumia 920 to take some crazy ass night shots. So you can take basically DSLR level night photos with this camera phone. And I think that's pretty ridiculous. So I think this thing could fundamentally change the way people view camera phones once it's finally released. Mm-hmm. It could be a good, way to convince people to buy this phone too.
But the 920 does not have a 41.
No, it's not 41 megapixels, but it's going to be very big. It's going to be they didn't give us a specific, but I would imagine at this point it's going to be between 10 and 15 megapixels, like most of their camera phones now. But at this point, the megapixels doesn't matter as much as like the tech behind it, and the tech behind it is pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. Really smooth video. Actually, they showed off some of this. Nokia they released like this commercial that had a simulated version of what this camera technology would look like. Mm-hmm. Then they have to apologize because everybody realized it was fake. So now if you look on a tech meme, or if you just look at Nokia's Conversations blog, they have a demo video of, I think it's the Galaxy S3 side by side with the Lumia 920, and just the video looks smooth. It looks like it's on a Steadicam almost. So it's kind of fantastic. And I think a lot of people, at least photo hounds, will really like that. Beyond that, it feels like a solid, great device. It's a phone that actually excites me much more than many Android phones do these days.
Do you feel like they have a good... I mean, I don't know. I guess I've been extremely skeptical of Windows phones since they came out with it. So, I mean, initially the question is, okay, can they actually deliver a good modern phone experience? And the answer to that seems to be good. Well, that seems to be the second question. I mean, like, they're still in third place in terms of
they're not
of
even
sales.
In third place. No.
They're not in third place. They're like 2, maybe 4% of the market.
They're close to overtaking RIM, or close to underfalling them.
Where I'm not sure what you've been looking at, Chris, but RIM is still actually selling. Their percentage is falling precipitously. But RIM is still ahead of Windows Phone quite a bit. Windows Phone is kind of sad at this point. I think total market share is around 2-3% from what I saw. They only sold a couple Lumias.
It's the platform, four max. Right, they're making more money after a deal with Apple and after a deal with Apple than they are selling devices right now.
Deal with HTC, I think.
Microsoft has a deal with HTC. Nokia has a deal with Apple. Some intellectual property things, and Nokia's probably making more money off that deal with Apple than they are making off the
Sony
device.
Probably. The platform has had problems since the beginning, right? They launched with a really well-designed OS, but all of those phones felt like they were just old-generation Android phones. They felt obsolete when they launched, so that was a problem, and nobody bought Windows phones for a year. Then the Nokia announcement happened.
With the 710 and the 900.
Give me a second. That Nokia-Microsoft partnership happened early 2011. Fast forward like 6 months, we finally see, the Lumia 800 and the Lumia 710. They look great. They look fantastic. They release it internationally. It's selling quite a bit, but not that much. Eventually, like what we learn at CES, we learned that the Lumia 900 was going to be the one hitting the U.S., a slightly bigger model, slightly faster processor. It hit. It was great. And it hit $100, which I thought was fantastic.
There were problems that had to bring it down. It's like its launch had all these issues.
There were a couple tech issues, but nothing that would have killed it outright. But one of the bigger problems is people who were really into this, who were really into getting a Lumia 900, a couple of months after it launched, we heard about Windows Phone 8, and then we learned that no current Windows Phone models will be upgraded to Windows Phone 8, which kind of killed any momentum that that platform had. So now here we are, Windows Phone 8 running on a Windows 8 kernel. It seems like Microsoft has finally figured out the software. It seems like Nokia has finally sort of mastered the hardware. And I feel like this year, potentially, we'll see a lot more traction. And I'm actually working on a post about this right now. I think the biggest traction will actually be with the combination of Windows Phone and Windows 8.
It's the
8.
Confluence. Yeah, Windows it's the confluence 8. Of that Metro, that not yeah. quite named Metro anymore, but that Windows 8 UI mm-hmm. that's going to be across all of their devices and give like a seamless thing to it. And I feel like MJ Siegler's article about how buy the tech you want as it is right now, don't expect to upgrade, particularly applies to Windows Phone devices.
I don't think that was MJ Siegler. I think that was Matt Buchanan. But okay. that was nothing gets better, basically. It never gets better.
Yeah, right.
Or but, you can't.
No, I'm not talking better. About UI here, Dwayne. I'm talking about ecosystem. We were talking about ecosystem, remember, with Amazon and how that kind of helped it spur on the Kindle Fire and make it the first truly successful Android
That's
tablet.
That's the problem with the Windows right. phones, with the Windows
right,
Phone
right.
7. It wasn't going to really be attached to the ecosystem in the same way, the way
right.
the Windows
they
8 is.
They were building up a fledgling ecosystem, but it had nothing to do with anything else Microsoft was doing.
Exactly.
So then they went back to the table, they brought the Windows 8 kernel to Windows Phone 8, and that allows easier transition of Windows 8, modern apps, Metro apps, to Windows Phone 8. And that I think is going to be huge. And Steve Ballmer said something really interesting today. Going to quote him here. He mm-hmm. said, in 1 year from now, we should see close to 400 million new devices running those operating systems. And he's talking about Windows Phone 8 and Windows 8. That means Lumia. That means Surface. Devices introduced in Berlin last year, blah, blah, blah. His the kicker to his quote, though, I think is going to be, is even in this post here. He basically said that these things will be the single biggest potential for developers the largest single opportunity for developers today. That's what he thinks all these this whole ecosystem will be. And if you think about it, if everything goes according to plan, mm-hmm. this is true. And Windows 8
about numbers
be,
yeah
yeah and Windows 8 will be the thing that Windows Phone needed to kind of launch and basically make itself more known to consumers. I feel like it'll support it in terms of apps. It'll support it in terms of getting it in the consumers' minds and potentially some deals like where people can buy a computer and get a Windows Phone or something. Those could all be worked out. But I think the potential here, we're seeing it right now for a crazy ecosystem. So I'm actually working on a post about this at this point.
And there's also just the fact that what's happening here is that, you know, Ballmer's like laying this all out and saying it, but the SDK for Windows 8 includes tools for Windows Phone 8. So when he talks about the developers having this big opportunity, he's in many ways speaking about the fact that the developer has to, it's not quite write once, run everywhere, but it definitely is, hey, you're going to see some of the same elements in the SDK we're giving you when it comes to building Windows 8 products and building Windows Phone 8 products. And I think that's going to be exciting for developers because they won't have to reinvent the wheel. Not that you have to with everything, with like iOS or whatever and macOS, but it's still something that I think developers will be excited about. Because remember, Windows still dominates in like 90% of desktop market share. So if companies that are not quite okay with bring your own device are still farming out things and they know that they can get what they want out of a Windows Phone with compatibility, open your OpenOffice document, it's exactly the same as when you're on your computer or whatever. There's no like kind of weird like trying to be compatible app or whatever.
Right, right.
That's really gonna spur their base, these companies, into thinking about this product.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about like Microsoft's 10-year plan with
right.
Windows 8, and
right.
basically this is what it's all shaping up to, you know, is that developers are going to start creating these touch-friendly apps, tablet-friendly apps, which will now, thanks to the new Windows 8 kernel and Windows Phone 8, those apps can easily hit mobile phones too. And we're kind of seeing it all come together at this point, so I'm excited. It's kind of, it's they're also doing something that even Apple didn't do. You know, Apple owned mobile, I think even well before they owned desktop. You know, it's only now that we're seeing Apple computers actually kind of leading in sales just as much mm-hmm. as, the iPod did or just as much as the iPhone did.
Mm-hmm.
But Microsoft has the potential to wrap it all up and kind of deliver a single computing ecosystem that could be compelling to a lot of consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my one thing is, like, the reason why developers have been so into the Windows platform for so long is not as much because it's awesome or write once, run anywhere. It's because it's a big platform that you run for, and you have an automatic market that you build it off of. And I guess my biggest worry from the developer's perspective is, well, is Windows 8 actually going to be a platform? I mean, I remember back, Devendra, when you and I were working on transferring over Amherst from Windows 2003 or Office 2003, sorry, to Office 2007, just the amount of like friction that we encountered with the ribbon interface. And I look at these, you know, things on Windows 2008 and the touch stuff, and I'm like, I mean, as a developer, I'm not at all convinced that if I write something for Windows 8, if I'm going to get it to run anywhere.
Not convinced yet, but they have basically the next year to prove you guys, you know, to prove to you guys that you build it on Windows 8 and it'll run on tablets, it'll run on desktops, and not with, with very little work, it'll probably run on phones. So if they can hook that, like, imagine if Apple had that opportunity, right? You can build a Mac app that would instantly work on iPhone. People would be drooling.
Right.
People would be jumping, you know. falling over each other.
And that's what they're driving for. That's like, that's their whole kit and caboodle. The idea that you wrote it here, you know what you need to do to get it into this small space, and it's going to be completely compatible. If they can pull that off and do it successfully, then the Windows app market should explode. And to be honest, you don't need 500,000, a billion apps to make your mobile platform work. You need probably a good 20,000 awesome apps. You know what I mean? We've all looked at the charts to show what people actually download, and it's not – people aren't rolling all through that 300 to 800,000 apps.
Right. quality definitely matters more than quantity. And honestly, you look at Android's ecosystem right now, right? You don't see too many developers going first in Android. Or if they did, and I've talked to a lot of
developers – And that was predicted. That was predicted back in like
I've heard from a lot of developers who were trying to do that, and they kind of gave up because there are no consumers there, or you can't make money on Android. So there's still a wide gaping opening for somebody to kind of deliver a good ecosystem competitor to iOS apps, because Android for a lot of developers isn't doing it, and a lot of big name developers I know just aren't even considering Android because they can't make money off of it. And that's a problem. Microsoft is all about helping people make money. That's what they've been talking about for a long time. Google has been less concerned about growing its ecosystem. So there's a huge opening here, I think.
And they've got to jump the hurdle of the indie guys. I know with MSDN is not cheap. The indie guys, they're going to need a little love from Microsoft. So they're going to have to figure out a way to get those guys from being disenfranchised. I mean, there's a lot of people making apps for Microsoft that are independent, but you know, when it comes to mobile, that's where the indie developer really, really shines. So, I mean, they have their institutionalized developers. Those guys are going to do great. But attracting those indie developers there, attracting them and saying, hey, get your idea on Windows Phone, that's where the hurdle for them is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And once they have the phone, I mean, like the big argument is like, Windows is on your computer. Use the phone with Windows. You know what I mean? Like it's already there. Like that's a no-brainer marketing situation. People are going to fall for it. It's just getting the really great innovative people to jump on there and take their platform to the next level. Because that's really what happened with iOS. The first iPhone, people talk about it today because it's 5 years old. Oh, it was the greatest phone that ever happened or whatever. It wasn't. It wasn't that. But when iOS 2 came out and they were able to put apps on that puppy, suddenly the iPhone was like, what?
Well, it was a very different game. Before, it was only Apple's game. Uh-huh. It was a very closed ecosystem. Yep. It was only Apple apps. It was, you can only do what Apple let you do. Exactly. But once Apple allowed that little bit of, like, I don't know, like just opened up the playpen a bit, we saw what people could do.
It was a floodgate. Yeah. And the big thing there is that no one company has the talent and the resources to make the most out of their platform. That's why developers are so important. That's why we're seeing all this weird friction on the social media platforms with people being like, wait, you don't want me to use your platform? Okay, fuck you. I'm going to try this app.net thing and all sort of nonsense. It's really just a question of like, can you accept the people that can bring the most out of your platform? And if you can do that, then, you know, we've seen that you can do well. Because even though Android is definitely not iOS in terms of apps, there are a crap ton of apps on there, and people love them.
Yeah, you know? Well, there are a crap ton of apps, but try to find a good Twitter app on Android. I dare you. Unless
including the official Twitter app,
which is terrible. Yeah, that's the thing. It's just like the big apps, Twitter. I hate the Twitter Android app, and only there's a good one for Android 4.0 that's in beta right now. I forget what it's called, but that's kind of the only good option. But anybody before not running Android 4.0 is kind of sore out of luck, and a lot of Android users may not know what they're missing out on with more polished, higher quality apps.
Decided they're gonna like start killing. I mean, it's because of Android. I think they started wanting to kill these client apps because of all the crap. Client apps that were showing up on
potentially, yeah. And there were a lot of web scrapers and stuff too. I'll say one more thing about the Lumia 920 and also the 820. The Lumia 920 out of the box supports wireless charging, which is kind of cool.
Oh, right.
Nokia is showing off all sorts of different, they're using the Qi wireless charging standard. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of accessories and things that work with that right now. So you could get like a little boombox or something mm-hmm. that you can also tap to pair with your phone using NFC. You could tap to pair it, or you could just drop the phone on it to charge and also stream music to it. There's a lot of cool stuff that they're doing. I think wireless charging, it feels kind of futuristic too. Mm-hmm. We saw some of it in action today. There are going to be all sorts of stands, all sorts of charging things, cute little like cushions you can have on your desk. You just plop your phone down and it's charging.
Nice.
I think that could be, that could be a cool thing too for the Lumia. So there's so much innovation going on in this phone that I'm kind of excited by it. I just hope they don't drop the ball. I hope Microsoft doesn't drop the ball like they have for the past couple of years. Uh-huh. And I hope Nokia can actually deliver. We don't have pricing information on these phones yet. We don't have release date information, and that kind of kills me. Hmm. So, yeah. It's like the Surface problem all over again.
Exactly. Microsoft has had a really hard time the last, honestly, 5 years. Like,
they can't market anything worth shit.
Well, don't tell them that.
Exactly. They overpromise and underdeliver. That's been the story of Microsoft the last.
Steve Ballmer is
since 2007. Like everything we've talked about is like, oh, Microsoft's going to do, you know, the new Kin. It's going to do the thing out of their Danger acquisition or the new Ribbon interface. It's always going to be awesome. And then it always ends up being like, well, it kind of did that thing that they said it was going to do. But like maybe the next version will really do it, you know, like. And that's OK if you're sort of working with an established base. But I mean, Microsoft's whole fundamental, their existential problem that they're dealing with right now is that the base that makes Microsoft Microsoft, i.e. their platform Windows and Office, is under fundamental attack. People are realizing that they don't need Office to get shit done, and they don't need Windows to get shit done. And that is the huge problem they need to deal with. And just sort of coming out with these, you know, cool tech demos every couple of years that sort of get watered down into mediocre products.
Right.
And then doing shit like, you know, constantly, you know, making it so that, oh, the newest version of Windows Phone doesn't deal with the old version of Windows Phone. I mean, that, as we've talked about before, even going back to the Symbiotic podcast, I mean, Microsoft's mm-hmm. fundamental value proposition has always been the backwards compatible platform that works forever. And if that doesn't happen on the phone, you buy a phone, a Windows phone, and it doesn't even work for one upgrade cycle. I mean, goodness, even Android does that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
I wouldn't go that far. Come on, let's back that up. Let's watch.
Android is kind of ridiculous in terms of their upgrade cycle. So that's a legitimate criticism. The thing is, like, I've definitely been down on Microsoft for what they did to Windows Phone 7 users, because, you know, it's not very many people. It's a couple million people at most, but these are kind of your core fans. These are the people who believed enough in you to buy your crap, you know, before it was truly proven. And they kind of left them out hanging. But I guess the end game to bring the Windows 8 kernel mm-hmm. in there, it was something that they didn't plan initially. And it's honestly, this all happened. Windows Phone was being worked on before Windows 8 was like, even that idea was being formed. Like, it was going to be targeting tablets. They were going to have all this whole focus. That's partially, by the way, now we're looking back into history, you know, as excited as I'm getting about Windows 8 tablets and hybrid devices now, this is why the Courier died, because Microsoft didn't want like an outlier device kind of eating up its tablet market share or something when Windows 8 should be doing everything. So I hear you, Chris. This is a problematic company. I think they are getting a little better. I definitely think so.
I also want to grunt to the defense on this one thing. Like, when you have the early adopters show up, they're taking that risk. Windows Phone 7 was a completely new Windows. They may as well have called it Windows Phone 1. And that OS and those devices, they simply couldn't be, even in this age where you can upgrade or whatever, they couldn't be relied upon to be future compatible. I think that we've seen from everyone from like Apple through RIM, you can't always like that first generation of stuff. Just avoid it if you want. If you want that upgrade cycle, if you want to wait, then wait. But that first generation is not meant for that. It's meant for the early adopters to show off and be like advocates for the brand.
Yeah. Well, so, Microsoft's problem though was that it was their second generation that they screwed over, so it was less excusable to me.
It's like several generations of this. And honestly, like, I don't know, we're all early adopter here. So I feel like our personal feelings here are important. I mean, if we, you're not an early adopter.
Well, I'm an early adopter. But I mean, when I talk about technology, I'm thinking of the people, not us.
Right.
Because they're just a much bigger demographic. You know, they're kind of the ones who matter. You got to think about the consumer. What's the line from Tron? I fight for the user. That's kind of what I do. You know, I think about what this means for consumers. And Chris and Dwayne, like, this is what we learned in IT as well. Like, as much as we want to adopt new and hot things, at the end of the day, you have to think about how it affects all the normal people who don't quite understand technology in your, you know, in your workplace.
You want to be leading edge, not bleeding edge.
Exactly.
Right. I think that's exactly where I sit. That's like why for me, Android tablets are such a big deal, because it's going to be difficult for me to transition off my personal handset onto an Android device. But a tablet, you can kind of take it or leave it, right? And I feel like that's kind of how it is with Windows Phone. Like, you got to have it. I mean, that's an intimate device, and people really have to be in a position where they can rely on it fully before it gets true widespread adoption. And that happened with the iPhone. Every year, the iPhone sells more than every other phone that was sold before it, because people are like, widespread adoption, this thing is working. This thing is working for what it is that I need to do. So,
ironically, Apple has stolen the whole backwards compatible thing. I mean, last year.
Well, sometimes some people get really upset about the fact that, like, Siri can probably totally work fine on the iPhone 4. But, I mean, I know there's the chipset thing with the whole thing with the way the speakers are. But for the most part, people don't understand why. That can't happen. Or perfectly.
It's just one of those things.
Why can't flyover work on the 3GS? The processor can handle it, but suddenly, no, you know, whatever. And maybe Apple's reeling from the 3G experience with iOS 4. But people see a lot of like not quite necessary non upwards compatibility. So if you have a what's it called? An original generation 1 Core i7 MacBook Pro. I'm talking a 15-inch, full top of the line Core i7. You bought it in 2010. It can't use AirPlay mirroring. If you bought a 2011 MacBook Air, it can't use a Thunderbolt display. So there are things, and the hardware can pull it off. But there are definitely things that Apple is doing that people still are not buying on the forward compatibility thing.
Let's wrap up this discussion here. There was one more announcement. Motorola announced a Droid Razr HD. Devendra, I gathered from what you had mentioned before that you weren't as thrilled about this as you were with the Nokia Lumia.
Yeah, Motorola announced a new Android phone. It's bigger. That's it. That's the news.
The numbers are larger.
It's Razr HD instead of Razr. Droid Razr. Well, HD Max is another model. Let's be clear. The Droid Razr HD is the initial one with the 25 milliamps battery. Mm-hmm. But there's the Razr Max
that has the 3300
milliamps battery. So
milliamps? Yeah. That is ridiculous.
It's big. Come on. We were talking about the Droid Razr Max, I think. Not the Razr Max, but the Droid 3 Max, I think it was, earlier this year. Mm-hmm. That was shown at CES. That came out earlier this year for the past Droid, the Droid 4 Max or something. I don't care. Guys, I don't care. Consumers don't care. Who cares?
Motorola, you fail.
Let me just let's look at the big contenders, right? Google, Motorola, Microsoft, Nokia, Apple. When I look at the Nokia devices, what they have in common with Apple, what they're taking that's clear to me, that's good to me, is that, yes, we've got two devices. That's what's up. Maybe in 9 months we'll release two more devices. But these two devices, this is it. This is what we're doing. This is where the focus is. This is what's up. Android still, with this sort of like old school Windows model, is really like, okay, Motorola's going to make some. HTC's going to make some. And in order to differentiate, they're going to have these names that are approaching the name of like television sets. Like my
it's not even the names.
They're meaningless. I mean, quick, what's the difference between the Galaxy Nexus and the Nexus 7? Quick. Like, I can't even, like, I'm trying to recommend to people. I'm like, oh, yeah, that tablet.
Yeah. Honestly, though, the names, I could care less about the names, guys. Like, sure, you could argue that's confusing to consumers. Sure. What I mainly care about, though, is innovation. And right. I am not seeing innovation in Android phones, aside from a handful of manufacturers. And actually, Samsung is one of them. HTC is one of them. Motorola used to be one of the kings of Android phones. I mean, the original Droid was the thing that helped Android kick off. But they just haven't been able to keep up, and especially since Motorola went to Google, they just haven't really done anything with it. So I don't care. Don't like you. There's so many other better options than the Droid Razr HD with a 4.7-inch display. Just look around. If you want an Android phone, get a Galaxy S3 or an HTC One X. What I really liked and which I played around with earlier this year was the HTC One S. And I have a feeling that the new iPhone is going to feel a lot like that phone, because that thing was a 4-inch, mm-hmm. or maybe like a 4.2-inch. It wasn't very big, but it was very thin, and it had a 16:9 display, and it felt really weird to be holding like a long, thin device that still felt comfortable in your hand. Hmm. Yeah, if you get a chance, just play around with that phone. It feels great. Like, few phones actually feel great in your hands. I don't think, as much as I love the design of the iPhone 4 and the 4S, it does not feel good in your hands. You can feel those edges. It hurts.
That's why you have
sometimes.
To have a case.
It hurts, though, if you're holding it for a long time. The HTC One S felt great. It was all metal. It was all good, mm-hmm. Which is something the new iPhone will likely have as well, the metal back. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm hoping the new iPhone feels like that.
All right, let's wrap this up here. Let's go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Devendra. Where can we find you on the internets when you're not here on the Drill Down?
I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about technology every day and many nights at venturebeat.com, and I podcast about TV and movies at slashfilm.com.
Are you going to have another I know you're on Slash Film, and you had done the Legend of Korra podcast. Mm-hmm. Are you planning on doing another offshoot podcast about another show?
We'll see it as it goes. Dave Chen, my Slash Filmcast co-host, loves to do different shows, different podcasts for other shows as well. But for me, Korra was just good, and I found a good group of people to chat with. We actually just put out a new episode discussing the potential Korra movie, so thanks for reminding me, Andy. That's at republiccitydispatch.com. Cool. I feel like we're going to just keep to that for now with one episode a month or so until we get other sorts of content.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
Twitter.com/DwayneD. That's twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD. And when our company blog finally launches, you can see me at intermediamedia.com's blog.
Cool. Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
Most regularly, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Brunor, CHRISBURNOR. And then probably second most commonly, you can find me at Startup Digest. I curate list of the best events in Silicon Valley and at startupdigest.com, and the best startup-related articles at startupdigest.com as well. And then at some point in the next month, I'm going to get my blog up again at chrisbrunor.com. The problem of being a developer is I'm constantly tinkering with my blog, which means I'm constantly breaking it. The program is more important
to me.
Know
when to say when.
No, never. Always more features.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, gplus.to/MrBabyMan. I'm waiting for Google Plus to give me my own, vanity URL. I don't know when that's going to happen. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network. On geeksofdoom.com, subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and we're in the upper right-hand corner sidebar there. Look for our show logo. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, other devices by going to stitcher.com. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, and geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. And I have to say that I'm starting to get the floodgates have started to open. I'm trickling in with a lot of people who want to talk about stories that they want to share on thedrilldown.com. So keep that up. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.